Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Understanding HER2 Low Breast Cancer. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo and was made possible through an independent grant from Merck & Co., Inc. I really want to thank them for the support of today's program. Now, to start, I just want to let you know how many people are on the call. We have over 130 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Afghanistan, Canada, and the Philippines. So it is a global call. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Danny Markabawe. And Dr. Markabawe is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Breast Medical Oncology at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And Dr. Markabawe will be discussing an overview of HER2 low breast cancer, including what is HER2 status, standard treatment options, including targeted therapy, how biomarker testing informs treatment decisions, new targeted treatments, updates on investigational new drugs and clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, what's new in the prevention and management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, as well as key questions to ask your healthcare team about quality of life concerns for HER2 low breast cancer. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Markabawe.
Thank you, Johnny. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for being here today. Whether you're a patient navigating this diagnosis or a caregiver supporting someone you love, please know how much I respect your strength and your commitment to learning about your health. Today, we're going to talk about a relatively new concept in breast cancer treatment called HER2 low. If you've seen this term on a pathology report or your oncology care team has brought it up, it can sound a bit confusing. Low usually sounds like a deficit or something bad. In the world of breast cancer treatment, identifying a tumor as HER2 low is actually a very positive piece of information. It acts like a key unlocking targeted treatment options that we didn't really have a few years ago. Our goal today is to demystify what this status means, look at how it shapes your treatment choices, highlight some exciting new advances, and talk deeply about how we maintain your quality of life every step of the way. So to understand HER2 low, let's first talk about what HER2 is. HER2 stands for Human Epidermal Growth Factor Receptor 2. Think of these receptors as tiny docking ports sitting on the outside of breast cells. In healthy cells, these docking ports receive signals telling the cells how to grow and divide. For a long time, doctors looked at breast cancer as a simple binary when it came to these docking ports. You were either HER2 positive, meaning the cells had way too many of them, which drives fast growth, or HER2 negative, meaning the cells had a normal low amount. But medicine has evolved. We realized that HER2 negative wasn't just one blanket category. Inside that group, many patients actually have a small measurable number of these HER2 receptors on their cancer cells. They aren't fully HER2 positive, but they aren't at absolute zero. Either this middle ground is what we now call HER2 low. So how do we find this out? We use something called biomarker testing. When a biopsy or a surgery is performed, a pathologist looks at the tissue under a microscope and uses special stains to count these receptors. It's often called an IHC test and is scored from 0 to 3+. A score of 3+ is what we consider positive. A score of 0 is what we consider truly HER2 negative. Score of 1+ or 2+ with a negative follow-up confirmation test, which we call a FISH test, are what we define as HER2 low. So So knowing this exact biomarker status is incredibly powerful. It changes the roadmap of the treatment options that we have available because it tells us exactly what tools will work best against the specific biology of the tumor. So now that we know these cells have a few HER2 receptors, how do we use that to our advantage treatment-wise? This brings us to the standard and new targeted treatment options. So historically, standard treatment options included traditional chemotherapy, hormone treatments, or immunotherapy, depending on other biomarkers. While traditional chemotherapy is effective, it travels through the whole body, affecting healthy cells alongside cancer cells. But for HER2-low breast cancer, we now have a class of targeted therapy called antibody-drug conjugates, or ADCs. I personally like to describe ADCs as medical smart bombs. Instead of flooding the body with chemotherapy, an ADC links a targeted antibody, which specifically looks and attaches to those HER2 receptors, directly to a potent chemotherapy payload. So the medicine travels through the bloodstream, ignores the healthy cells for the most part, and then attaches directly to the HER2-low cancer cell. The cell pulls the medicine inside, and only then is the active treatment released to destroy the cancer cell from within. Even better, this medicine can cross over to destroy neighboring cancer cells nearby, an effect that we call the bystander effect. The primary target therapy approved for this is trastuzumab deruxtecan, or Enhertu. This medicine has completely shifted how we approach HER2-low breast cancer, offering a highly effective option that specifically spares a lot of the healthy tissue in the body. But as exciting as our current target treatments are, research never stands still. We're constantly looking for ways to make these treatments even more precise, more effective, and easier to tolerate. Right now, there is a robust pipeline of investigational new drugs moving through clinical trials. Research are developing next-generation antibody-drug conjugates that target HER2-low cells with different types of payloads or even more refined antibodies. There are also trials looking at combining these targeted therapies with immunotherapies to help your body's own immune system recognize and fight the cancer more effectively. I always tell my patients that clinical trials are not a last resort. They represent the absolute cutting edge of medicine. Participating in a clinical trial means gaining access to tomorrow's treatments today, all while being monitored with a high level of specialized care. Every single standard therapy we use today exists because patients and caregivers before you partnered with researchers to move the science forward. If you're interested, asking your team if a clinical trial is right for your specific stage of care is an excellent conversation to have in clinic. I want to shift gears towards side effect management. While we are incredibly focused on treating the cancer, our number one priority is treating you, the person. Managing side effects, preventing discomfort, and controlling pain are just as vital as the therapies themselves. We have made immense strides in what we call supportive care. Today, we don't wait for you to feel sick to treat the side effects. We act proactively to prevent them from happening in the first place. So I wanted to highlight some of the new advances we have in managing your well-being. In terms of nausea prevention, the medications we use to prevent nausea alongside targeted therapies have gotten incredibly sophisticated. We now use combinations of medicine given before treatment that block nausea signal in the brain and the stomach completely, making the experience much smoother. We also monitor your lung health quite closely while receiving Enhertu or trastuzumab deruxtecan, as this treatment can cause a rare side effect of lung inflammation called pneumonitis. So today, oncology teams are highly trained to catch this early. With routine imaging and awareness of simple symptoms like a new cough or shortness of breath, we can manage this easily and safely with temporary medication adjustment or administration of steroids. In terms of pain management, no one should really tough it out through pain or discomfort. We now use a multimodal approach to pain. This means combining targeted nerve medications, anti-inflammatories, and even specialized physical therapy alongside traditional options to manage discomfort, keep you moving and active. We also utilize integrative medicine quite frequently. Combine medical therapies with guided exercise, nutrition, and stress reduction techniques. combat the unique fatigue that can come with treatment. So pivoting towards quality of life questions that you can ask your care team, your oncology team really wants to hear from you, but it can be hard to know what to ask when you're sitting in the clinic. Quality of life is a vital part of your treatment plan, and you have every right to advocate for it. So here are a few questions I encourage you to write down and take to your next appointment. Based on my biomarker testing, am I a candidate for HER2-low targeted therapies now, or might I be in the future? What are the most common side effects of the specific treatments you are recommending? And what is your proactive plan to prevent them? Who should I call if I experience a new symptom at home? What support services do you have available here, such as oncology nutritionists, social workers, physical therapists, or palliative care specialists? Help me maintain my day-to-day energy and well-being. And at the end, I would like to conclude by saying that breast cancer has entered an era of incredible precision. By identifying HER2-low status, we are no longer guessing. We are tailoring medicine directly to the unique thumbprint of your cancer, while working harder than ever to protect your daily joy, comfort, and peace of mind. Just know that you're not alone in this journey. You have a dedicated team of doctors, nurses, researchers, and fellow family members walking right alongside you. Thank you so much for your time today, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions you or your loved ones might have at the end.
Thank you, Dr. Markabale. And our next presenter is Dr. Amy Zhang, and Dr. Zhang is attending pathologist, breast pathologist, Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Zhang will be discussing diagnostic testing, what is an immunohistochemistry IHC test or fluorescence in situ hybridization FISH test, as well as the role of the pathologist. It's my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Zhang.
Hi, good afternoon. I am a breast pathologist who analyzes the breast cancer specimens. And I'm going to briefly talk about the history of HER2 testing and its evolution of the new category of HER2-low and maybe HER2-ultra-low tumors. Since the clinical application of this trastuzumab in the management of breast cancers, a rigid binary scoring system has been utilized to study, analyze the HER2. The patient was either HER2 positive or HER2 negative. And the positive patients obviously are eligible for targeted anti-HER2 therapy, and the other group is not. So the testing modalities includes immunohistochemistry, IHC, and the fluorescence in situ hybridization FISH. So the IHC testing uses this chromogen attached to an antibody targeted the HER2 protein, which they combines to the HER2 protein on the cell surface. And based on the staining intensity and quantity, the tumor is classified as HER2 IHC 0 to 3+. And then the 3+ is automatically considered to be HER2 positive. And it's defined like in complete and intense membrane staining in more than 10% of the tumor cells. And then if it's only like less than 10% of the tumor cells shows intense membrane staining, or weak and to moderate complete membrane staining in more than 10% of the cells, and this is classified as IHC 2+, which is considered to be equivocal by IHC testing. And the FISH study will kick in to further classify these. And the FISH testing uses this fluorescence attached to a DNA probe. This will hybridize or binds to the DNA segment of HER2 genes located in the chromosome 17. Usually a dual probe system is utilized, like the fluorescence signal of HER2 gene is compared with this centromere signal of 17, chromosome 17. If the ratio is more than 2, the HER2 gene is considered to be amplified and the tumor is considered to be HER2 positive. That's these HER2 strong positive tumors, including the IHC3+ and then HER2 2+ with the HER2 gene amplified by FISH. And this rigid two-binary system has been utilized since late 1990s, all the way for the next two decades about. And the medical community noticed this high inter-laboratory and inter-observer variabilities in the HER2 testing and interpretation of HER2 results. That's why the ASCO stands for the American Society of Clinical Oncologists, and CAP, standing for College of American Pathologists. They convened an expert panel to come up a guideline to standardize the HER2 testing process and scoring and interpretation of HER2 results. The first guideline is officially published in 2007, and it was has been updated in 2013, 17, and in 2023. The most recent update is the current guidelines we're using in the U.S. Pathology laboratories and some of the CAP regulated international laboratories also. And historically, the medical fields noticed that there, even for these HER2 negative patients, by this binary system, expresses some levels of HER2 protein on the cell surface, on the tumor surface. And the landmark data, clinical data by DESTINY-Breast04 demonstrated this definite clinical benefit of this ADC TDXD on this proportion, like a subset of HER2 negative patients. So this phenomenon, like this finding, prompts to the reevaluation, reclassification of HER2 testing. So a new category has been recognized first time officially in 2023 CAP guideline. It is HER2 low. It is defined as this breast tumor expresses low, weak to moderate membrane staining in more than 10% of the tumor cells, or less than 10% strong intense membrane staining in less than 10% IHC2+, but FISH HER2 not amplified, and plus the tumor with IHC1+ staining pattern. So this groups as a new identified category of HER2 low. And furthermore, the DESTINY-Breast 06 and 04 also, like demonstrated this clinical benefits of ADCs in the subset of previously we assigned as IHC0 the patients, like there's a clinical benefits. So now there's a new concept of HER2 ultra low is introduced. It defines as this very faint, perceptible, like, barely perceptible membrane stains in less than 10%. So now we score them as HER2 IHC 0+. So as you can tell, like the pathologist's role evolved in the past decade, 22 decades. From our primary role before was identifying those HER2 high tumors to benefit from anti-HER2 therapy, but our role now is to identify HER2 low and HER2 ultra low patients who can benefit from new generation anti-HER2 therapy. And also our role is to make sure that those true negative IHC 0 and negative patients will not receive the toxic toxicity from unnecessary treatment. This is the paradigm shifts of a pathologist, because in the modern breast cancer management field, this outcome is totally depends on how precise that pathology can assign a tumor in this fluid spectrum of HER2 protein expression pattern. So the because we're challenging the human eye detection limits, so the future direction, which is under extensive exploration, is to integrate quantitative digital image analysis and AI algorithms to achieve more objective measurements of receptor density, especially for this HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low group of patients. And this is just a general outline, and I'm ready for any questions like by the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zhang. And our next speaker is Ms. Cara Rogan. And Ms. Rogan is a licensed certified genetic counselor, Department of Clinical Genomics at Mayo Clinic. And Ms. Rogan will be discussing the role of the genetic counselor. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Rogan.
Thank you for the introduction and for having me today, and thank you to all of our attendees for being here. The role of a genetic counselor is to help facilitate and guide patients diagnosed with breast cancer through the process of germline genetic testing. Germline genetic testing refers to testing performed on a blood or saliva sample that looks for disruptive changes, or what we call mutations, in the genes that you were born with. About 5 to 10% of women and 20% of men diagnosed with breast cancer are found to have an underlying genetic cause for their breast cancer. And the likelihood of finding an underlying genetic cause is higher in individuals that have a personal or family history of breast, ovarian, prostate, or pancreatic cancer. For an individual that has a hereditary breast cancer gene mutation, their lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is higher than the average woman's risk of 12 to 13%, and the average man's risk of less than 1%. At some institutions, genetic testing is offered to everyone with breast cancer, while some institutions may have some slightly stricter guidelines regarding who's offered testing. The first genes identified that are linked to hereditary breast cancer were the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, sometimes referred to as the BRCA genes. And prior to 2013, these were the only genes available for clinical testing. We now test for more genes linked to hereditary risk for breast cancer, such as ATM, CHEK2, PALB2, and others. Some individuals who previously had negative genetic testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2 only would be eligible for updated multi-gene panel testing because that BRCA-only testing is considered quite limited by today's standards. And in addition, since 2018, the option of paired DNA and RNA analysis on a blood sample has also been available. And the addition of RNA analysis increases the likelihood of a positive test in less than 1% of the individuals who are tested. So that's kind of another updated option we have for people. At a genetic counseling appointment, the genetic counselor reviews what will be tested, the possible results received from testing, and what the results mean for the patient and their family members. They also discuss insurance coverage of testing and laws surrounding genetic discrimination. And once the results are available, the genetic counselor reviews and interprets the genetic test results for the patient. One benefit of genetic testing is for treatment of HER2-low breast cancer. Individuals with a mutation in one of the BRCA genes or possibly some other genes like PALB2 can sometimes benefit from treatment using a drug called a PARP inhibitor. And that usually depends on some other features of their breast cancer as well, whether or not they'd be eligible for that drug. But the genetic test mutation is one of the eligibility criteria. In addition, women with mutations in certain genes can have an increased risk of getting another breast cancer diagnosed in the future. And so sometimes women use the results of the genetic test to say, I have an increased risk of getting another breast cancer, and I'm going to do bilateral mastectomies to remove the breast tissue and keep my chances of that second breast cancer as low as possible. or to do some enhanced screening for any breast tissue that's remaining if they choose not to do bilateral mastectomies. And that kind of leads me to my next discussion point about the benefit of genetic testing, which would be to identify other cancer risks for the patient and their relatives. If a gene mutation is identified that explains the breast cancer, that gene probably is going to increase the risk for other cancer types as well. And so then high-risk screening or preventive measures can be implemented to either prevent that cancer or detect it at an early stage. When a gene mutation is identified in someone with breast cancer, genetic testing is recommended for their relatives. Their first-degree relatives, such as their parents, siblings, and children, have a 50% chance of having that same gene mutation. For relatives who are found to have that same gene mutation, we would then recommend some screening and preventive measures for them. So for instance, in women with a hereditary breast cancer syndrome, breast cancer screening typically starts at an early age, sometimes age 25, sometimes age 30. And it usually includes both a breast MRI and a mammogram every year. And then for some genes with high risks for breast cancer, women can consider risk-reducing mastectomies even before they're diagnosed with breast cancer to reduce their chances of getting breast cancer quite significantly. And for men with a hereditary breast cancer syndrome, we recommend doing clinical breast exams in their 30s, and sometimes we'll even offer and consider a mammogram when they're in their 50s. So just for some last couple thoughts here, genetics is a rapidly changing field. We're making new discoveries every day about the hereditary causes of cancer, how to improve our genetic tests, and how to best manage hereditary cancer risks. We will continue to gain insight into the exact cancer risks associated with each gene, as there is some uncertainty at this time. And genetic counselors really remain at the forefront of all of those changes to educate both patients and providers about advances in the field. Genetic counselors are also available to help families cope with a diagnosis of hereditary cancer and empower them to be proactive regarding their cancer risks. And genetic counselors also partner closely with the rest of the care team to communicate results and current medical management guidelines. We also help connect patients and their families with available resources and research studies. And that is what I have for you all today. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Ms. Rogan. And our next speaker is Ms. Jennifer LaPietra. And Ms. LaPietra is an oncology social worker, as well as our patient assistance program manager here at Cancer Care. Ms. LaPietra will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as our Hope Line and website. Now, my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. LaPietra.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for the introduction, Ms. Nazarian. I am so happy to be here, and it's a privilege and an honor to be in today's program. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and potential financial assistance. In my role at Cancer Care, I provide supportive services to individuals and families impacted by a cancer diagnosis. A breast cancer diagnosis can be overwhelming. Additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a support network, may help to relieve feelings of anxiety related to one's diagnosis and may be addressed through psychosocial supportive services. Making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed in counseling with an oncology social worker or by participating in a support group. Joining a support group may be a way of connecting with others going through a similar experience who understand what you encounter throughout your diagnosis and treatments. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences as you are, obtain information, and provide support, rather. Currently, Cancer Care offers several breast cancer-specific support groups online. The Breast Cancer Online Support Group aims to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources, and address ways to communicate with one's medical team and loved ones. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and group members must register to join. You can register for an online support group through cancercare.org by selecting Our Services, then Support Groups. After completing the registration process on our website, members can participate by posting in the groups 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout treatment, and it might be helpful to discuss your concern with your medical providers. It may also be helpful to speak with an oncology social worker, patient navigator, and the financial department at the treatment center to see if there are any financial options available for you. Cancer Care's resource navigation offers a short-term, strengths-based approach service to both patients and caregivers. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. On Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, you will find a wide array of reading material and information related to breast cancer, as well as stories of help and hope. If you are interested in learning more about the support services we offer, I encourage you to call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 and speak with one of our oncology social workers. Our oncology social workers are trained on how a breast cancer diagnosis can impact an individual as well as their loved ones. Please know we are here to offer you support throughout your experience. Thank you for your attention and opportunity to speak in this informative program. I will now turn our program back over to Ms. Nazarian.
Thank you so much, Ms. LaPietra. Now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
All right, another question here for Ms. Rogan. Genetic testing and social impact of health, which one possesses high risk?
I'm not sure I fully understand that question. Can you read it one more time?
Yeah, so genetic testing and social impact of health, which one possess high risk? I believe it's asking in comparison to compare genetic testing versus maybe more environmental or social environmental influence.
Sure, yeah. I mean, for people that have an underlying hereditary condition, some of the genes are associated with pretty significant increased risks for breast cancer. There are some genes that we test that are associated with like moderately increased risks for breast cancer. So it's still higher than the average woman, but not as high as some of the high risk genes. And so I think that, you know, for some of those moderate risk genes, there certainly could be more influence of, you know, environmental exposures, lifestyle factors, things like that. You know, in the absence of a gene mutation, there are aspects of our, you know, lives, environmental exposures, lifestyle factors, things like that, that can influence risk for breast cancer, but probably not as high as having one of those high-risk gene mutations. So I hope that answers the question.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ms. Rogan. A question here for Dr. Marco Balwe. How do you monitor lung health?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the thing that has been shown to be most helpful is PET scans of the lungs. So my practice is to get a CAT scan of the lungs every 9 to 10 weeks. It's usually done without contrast, just to see or to look for signs of inflammation. There has been some trial that looked at pulmonary function tests. I haven't really been shown to be helpful in that setting. You're talking about looking for inflammation from the Enhertu, from the trastuzumab direct statement.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Markabawe. Question for Dr. Zhang. Is the test for HER2 low and ultra low in the IHC test? Also, if a patient has either, how would it affect first line of treatment?
Can you reread this question?
Yeah, so for the first part of the question, is the test for HER2 low and ultra low in the IHC test? And then also, if a patient has either, how would it affect first-line treatment? I don't know if Dr. Markabawe would answer the second question as well.
Right. Yes. The HER2 testing, actually, the HER2 low and ultra low, is used the same antibody, same testing process. It just scoring system changed, has been revised due to the new development of the ADCs. So the testing are the same. It just we visited the data, the clinical data, and then pull those patients it used to be considered, both groups used to be considered the HER2 negative, and now the IHC 2 plus and HER2 not amplified, and IHC 1 plus will be HER2 out low, and the ultra low refers to used to be IHC 0, but truly is IHC 0 plus with some very faint, bearable, perceptible stains, like membrane stains of on HER2 testing. This is the same test. Regarding the testing, the clinical impact, I think it should be the medical oncologist's question.
Yeah. Dr. Markabawe, do you want to comment on first-line treatment for HER2-low and ultra-low?
Yeah, so the majority of cancers that are HER2 low are estrogen receptor positive as well. And so right now the FDA approval is for first-line chemotherapy use. So that would basically come after we have, exhausted all of our endocrine therapy or hormonal therapy options. As of now, there's really no data to support using Enhertu in the first-line setting. However, there are trials looking at using Enhertu in the first-line setting, either in combination with the hormonal therapies or as an induction, short course of induction, followed by maintenance hormonal therapies.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Markabawe. I have a question for Ms. Rogan. Could you provide your opinion on blood tests such as GRAIL, GRAIL, which tests for 50 cancers?
Yeah, so the GRAIL test is a little different than the genetic testing that I was talking about. So the genetic testing I was talking about looks to see if you were born with any mutations that would increase your likelihood of developing certain cancers compared to the general population risk. The GRAIL test is a blood test that is screening to see if you currently have cancer, and it's using genetic material to do so. So I do think it often gets confused with genetic testing, but it's not genetic testing how we would usually think about it. The GRAIL test is, I think it's been around for 5 years, clinically outside of the research study. It seems to be showing quite a bit of promise, although it is a lot better at detecting a stage 3 and stage 4 cancer as opposed to stage 1 and stage 2, which is where we'd prefer to find cancer. Because it's looking to see if you currently have cancer, it's not going to tell you if you have any future cancers. So it is something that needs to be repeated multiple times over the lifetime versus like the genetic testing I was talking about can be repeated, but we usually only repeat it if there are upgrades to the testing technology itself, because your genetic material stays the same for your whole entire life. Right now, we don't feel like GRAIL should replace any standard screening, so we still recommend mammograms every year for women. We still recommend colonoscopies starting at age 45 every 10 years, and any other standard screenings that might be indicated. I think another important thing about GRAIL for the audience here is that I believe they do not want people to use it within 2 years of being diagnosed with a cancer, so kind of have to be 2 years cancer-free before you're eligible for it, because they don't want it to screen positive and be picking up on your previous cancer diagnosis. They are really intending to use it to diagnose a new cancer. So it's not a test that I ever order, but I get a lot of questions about it, and that's kind of what I've learned about it. But some of the information I'm sharing may be incorrect, just since it's not a test that I'm regularly ordering.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Rogan. Right, and for Dr. Marco Bawe, is there a specific subtype that clinical trials are looking to enroll for HER2-low research? Would this be HER2 negative patients or patients who fall under HER2 low?
I'm not sure if I understand the question correctly, but there are clinical trials looking at, you know, putting up HER2 and HER2 for treatment of HER2 low breast cancer. So basically using it in earlier lines, which I had mentioned earlier. And then in terms of truly HER2, called HER2 null or HER2 zero disease, there has actually been some trials that showed potential benefit from HER2, and so those were smaller trials. There is an ongoing larger trial looking at using that medicine in patients with truly HER2 zero disease. So, you know, I would say stay tuned. We know we might even, you know, find benefit in that patient population as well.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Marco Bawe. I have a question for Dr. Zhang. How do you advocate to see a pathologist specialist?
Yeah, there's generally speaking, where you have your materials read, those are primary, like in the pathologist for you. If you prefer it to be evaluated, especially for equivocal cases or questionable, and you can refer to the expert locally. Each hospital, every city has the larger medical centers, and also the cancer specialized hospitals, nationally. So it's always easy to approach them directly or refer by your medical oncologist. Those are two means. You can approach the pathology experts by yourself to the hospital or pathology themselves, or through the medical oncologist in your primary institution. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Zhang. A question, another one for Ms. Rogan. I was diagnosed at 43 and had 3 renditions of genetic testing and do not possess any of the high penetrance mutations. Should my daughter start mammograms at 33?
Yeah, so, you know, even when we have a negative genetic test result, we still think that there could be some familial predisposition, whether it's a gene that we haven't discovered yet, a mutation that we can't detect with our current testing, or maybe it's not just a single gene, but some combination of genetics plus environment. So whenever we get a negative test result, we always look at the family history and say, you know, maybe there are still some screenings that should be done. And so generally, when there's a family history of breast cancer, we, with a negative genetic test result, we recommend starting mammograms 10 years before the youngest diagnosis of breast cancer, but no later than age 40. So 33 in your situation would be correct, yes, unless there's someone else in your family who was diagnosed younger than yourself. There is also a computer model we use called Tyrer-Cuzick or IBIS that can calculate someone's lifetime risk for breast cancer. And if it's above a certain threshold, then we'll also talk to those women about doing breast MRIs as well as their annual mammograms. So despite your negative genetic testing, your daughter should start breast cancer screening at 33 and have that risk model run to know whether or not they should be adding in those breast MRIs as well.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Rogan. Another question here for Dr. Marco Bawe. If one antibody drug conjugate stops working on a HER2-low or HER2-positive breast cancer patient, does it make sense for that patient to try another ADC, or are subsequent ADCs unlikely to provide a response?
That's an excellent question. Unfortunately, we don't have the answer yet. There are ongoing trials looking at sequencing ADCs. So for breast cancer, we have 3 ADCs that are approved right now. The issue is that the chemotherapy payload is kind of similar in terms of how it works between those ADCs. So we're not 100% sure that, you know, trying another ADC after progression on the first ADC is going to be beneficial. It definitely seems like the benefit is less with the second ADC from, you know, what we call real world data. However, there are ongoing trials looking at sequencing these medicines.
Thank you so much, Dr. Marco Bawe. Another question for you. If a patient had HER2-negative breast cancer, can it change to HER2-low, and how would this be detected?
That's another excellent question. Yes, so that can happen. And there was actually a paper presented at the ASCO conference 3 years ago, and they basically showed that you know, if we repeat the biopsy up to 5 times, everyone had some form of expression of HER2. You know, especially with the HER2 ultra low designation, I think, you know, the majority of cancers are, you know, going to express HER2 at some point. So the way we would find that out is by repeating the biopsy at this point.
Okay. Thank you so much. Right. A few more questions. A follow-up question for that, Dr. Marco Bawe. Can HER2 status change based on recurrence and spread?
Yes. So, you know, I guess it depends on, you know, sometimes, you know, the disease was ER positive to begin with. You know, if we, you know, if it recurs, the most common site of recurrence is the bones. However, if we see more visceral metastases, you know, the lungs or the livers, those can indicate that the tumor might may be expressing more HER2.
Thank you. I have a question here for Ms. Rogan. There used to be a genetic test specifically for patients with Ashkenazi background. Do you still test specific cultural backgrounds in a different way?
Not really. There are three specific mutations in BRCA1 and BRCA2 that are seen most commonly in individuals with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. I have seen a few patients that report no Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry that have one of those three mutations. So we certainly can see it outside of that. And, you know, outside of their ancestry, they can have some of the same mutations and some of the other genes that people who are non-Ashkenazi Jewish can have as well. So, you know, when I meet with someone who has Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, that just makes me feel a little bit more confident that genetic testing will be covered by insurance. It usually is covered by insurance these days. But because those BRCA mutations are more common in people with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, we're usually able to get testing covered pretty well, but we would look at other genes related to hereditary risk for breast cancer beyond just those three mutations. And here at Mayo is where I work, we kind of recently decided to stop asking people about their ancestry, like, you know, are you African-American, Hispanic, Norwegian? We do still ask about Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, but other than that, there doesn't really seem to be any we don't use that information about ancestry to guide like what testing is done. So I think it is a question that other genetics providers will probably stop asking at some point in the future here as well.
Great. Thank you very much. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide their takeaways. We'll start with Dr. Markabawe, then Dr. Zhang, Ms. Rogan, and then Ms. LaPietra. So Dr. Markabawe, your takeaway?
Yeah, my takeaway is, you know, the field of breast medical oncology is progressing quite rapidly. It's, you know, it's quite exciting to be a breast medical oncologist. At this time, you know, treatment options have exploded and they're becoming more precise and much better tolerated. I encourage patients to enroll or consider enrolling in clinical trials at every opportunity, you know, that could provide potentially access to highly effective drugs prior to regulatory approval, prior to the target being available by the FDA.
Thank you, Dr. Markabawe. And Dr. Zhang?
Hi. The testing for HER2 has been evolving quickly due to the urge clinically proposed, like the new development of ADCs and et cetera. So the HER2 low and ultra low becomes more a clinical challenge. And the patient, you know, needs to be aware, like when your HER2 status falls into these categories, and then your treatment options are expanded. So, and there's always possible to seek a second opinion on any pathology evaluation of the breast cancer specimens. And then they are approachable by personal consult and referrals, like through your medical, oncologists or surgeons, or by yourself, refer for personal consult. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Zhang. And Ms. Rogan?
Yeah, I think my takeaway would just be that genetic testing can be beneficial for patients with breast cancer for helping to treat the breast cancer, but also identifying future cancer risks in themselves and in their family members. And we can use that information to be proactive to take steps for risk management through screening and preventive measures. And if you've already done genetic testing in the past, depending on how long ago it was or what was all included on the testing, there may be new testing that could be considered at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Rogan. And Ms. LaPietra?
Thank you so much. I think two takeaways that I have for our attendees today is to really recognize that there's a lot of information that is shared in your medical appointments and consultations. And so we always encourage if you could either take notes on a phone app or in a notebook, bring a family member with you for extra support and an extra set of ears can be really helpful so that you can follow up on additional questions that may come up. And also know that Cancer Care is here to support you as you go through this experience. So we encourage you to call and hopefully make some meaningful connections and get good information that will be valuable for you. Thank you so much for your attention today.
Thank you, Ms. LaPietra. I just want to take a moment now to thank all of our speakers. We had a phenomenal panel today. And I also want to thank our participants for being on this call. Today's program was particularly exceptional because of the questions that were asked and the way our speakers addressed those questions. Now, I do want to say a few words, though, for those of you that didn't have your question answered, if you were typing your question, or even if you did have your question answered, I would like you to go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions as they know you best. Please remember that you've learned a great deal from today's program. I want you to take what you've learned, go back to your treating healthcare team, and ask them your questions again and again. Lastly, I want to remind everyone it's important to know who to contact on your healthcare team on evenings, weekends, and holidays in advance. So it's oftentimes when you do need to reach them. And I don't want anyone to leave this workshop feeling as if they are alone. As Ms. LaPietra mentioned, we at Cancer Care, whether you have a community of support, we are here for you. You are not alone. And I want to thank everyone for their participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.